Good morning. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. I'm continuing reading Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter by Ben Goldfarb. This book was published in 2018 by Chelsea Green Publishing, White River Junction, Vermont. This book mainly focuses on areas west of the 100th Meridian, but certainly it has a wealth of information that applies to everywhere there are watersheds. It traces the history of beaver trapping, leading to their extirpation, and into the present as they are gradually reappearing, and the book explores problems that arise when beavers and people conflict. Biologist Drew Reed, who was introduced last week, and Ruth Shea, a trumpeter swan researcher, set out to try to resolve the conflicts without killing the beavers, but instead relocating them to areas where they can thrive. This, in fact, improves swan habitat at the same time. We'll return to the Jackson Hole, Wyoming region. I'll finish with a recent news article about beavers stymieing Russian overland advances into Ukraine from Belarus because of the increase in beaver numbers in that border area, making it too wet and impassable. Prior to the February 2022 invasion, beaver numbers had been suppressed by local people. And now more of the introduction to Eager, The Surprising Secret Life of Beavers and Why They Matter by Ben Goldfarb. By the dawn of the 20th century, the fur trade had largely dissolved, a victim of its own success. Beavers began to recover, much to the chagrin of Jackson's landowners, who rang up wildlife-controlled trappers whenever the rodents gnawed down cottonwoods, dammed irrigation ditches, or flooded fields. No longer did we regard beavers primarily as pelts, just pests. That didn't sit right with Drew Reed, an Arkansas native, who in 2008 took a job at the Wyoming Wetlands Society. Intrigued by beavers' ecological potential, Reed set out to make capture and relocation a priority. He taught himself to live trap and hung up flyers advertising his services. Word of Reed's humane approach spread among Jackson's wildlife-loving citizenry like brush fire in dry grass. All of a sudden, my phone was ringing off the hook, he told me. Some trappers threatened their new competitor. Others referred him clients. Before long, he was dumping beavers in the Gros Ventre River two or three times a week. In 2015, Reed and Shea, Ruth Shea, who was introduced last week, scraped together funding for a new nonprofit, the Northern Rockies Trumpeter Swan Stewards. Birds may be their remit, but their focus is beavers. Usually, Reed arrests his quarry in suitcase-like live traps, though sometimes he's forced to get creative. Just before I came to Jackson Hole, he wrangled an especially wily fugitive with a salmon net. A harebrained scheme, he gleefully acknowledged. It was utter chaos when that beaver hit the net. It was a rodeo. He held on. The beaver was moved. All told, Reed estimates he's relocated north of 250 beavers. How many have survived is another question. Although he's recaptured some old friends years later, many no doubt have been devoured by bears, wolves, and cougars or slain by trappers. Without Reed, though, their fate would have been more certain and grimmer. Even if one landowner is willing to let the beavers stay, their neighbors probably won't. And we all know that beavers don't understand what a property line is, he told me. I'm usually given an ultimatum. You relocate them or they're dead. We're giving them a second lease on life, a chance to try to go make it. I call it reseeding a drainage. They're not going to stay exactly where you put them, but I'm happy if they stay somewhere in the area and start doing their work. As if on cue, Reed threw the truck in park and raised binoculars, ogling a lodge protruding from a distant pond. The structure, he told me, was likely the handiwork of a relocatee. He'd recently spotted one of his ear-tagged beavers cruising around the complex. "Oh, heck yeah, that thing has grown," he enthused. "That's 3 times the size it was a couple years ago." He gazed into the floodplain below, the wide sagebrush pasture, parched and sepia and swanless as it rolled away from the river. Close your eyes. Picture, if you will, a healthy stream. What comes to mind? Perhaps you've conjured a crystalline, fast-moving creek bounding merrily over rocks, its course narrow and shallow enough that you could leap or wade across the channel. If, like me, you're a fly fisherman, you might add a cheerful, knee-deep angler casting for trout in a limpid riffle. It's a lovely picture, fit for an Orvis catalog. It's also wrong. Let's try again. This time, I want you to perform a more difficult imaginative feat. Instead of envisioning a present-day stream, I want you to reach into the past, before the mountain men, before the pilgrims, before Hudson and Champlain and the other horsemen of the Furcopolips, all the way back to the 1500s. I want you to imagine the streams that existed before global capitalism purged a continent of its dam-building, water-storing, and wetland-creating engineers. I want you to imagine a landscape with its full complement of beavers. What do you see this time? No longer is our stream a pellucid, narrow, racing trickle. Instead, it's a sluggish, murky swamp, backed up several acres by a messy concatenation of woody dams. Gnawed stumps ring the marsh like punji sticks. Dead and dying trees stand aslant in the chest-deep pond. When you step into the water, you feel not rocks underfoot, but sludge. The musty stink of decomposition wafts into your nostrils. If there's a fisherman here, he's thrashing angrily in the willows, his fly caught in a tree. Although this beavery tableau isn't going to appear in any field and stream spreads, it's in many cases a more historically accurate picture, and in crucial ways a much healthier one. In the Intermountain West, wetlands, though they make up just 2% of total land area, support 80% of biodiversity. You may not hear the tinkle of running water in our swamp, but listen closely for the songs of warblers and flycatchers perched in creekside willows. Frogs croak along the pond's marshy aprons. Otters chase trout through the submerged branches of downed trees, the forest inverted. The deep water and the close vegetation make the fishing tough, sure, but abundant trout shelter in the meandering side channels and cold depths. In A River Runs Through It, Norman MacLean captured the trials and ecstasies of angling in beaver country when he wrote of one character. So off he went happily to wade in ooze and to get throttled by brush and to fall through loose piles of sticks called beaver dams and end up with a wreath of seaweed round his neck and a basket full of fish. And it's not just fishermen and wildlife who benefit. The weight of the pond presses water deep into the ground, recharging aquifers for use by downstream farms and ranches. Sediment and pollutants filter out in the slack waters, cleansing flows. Floods dissipate in the ponds. Wildfires hiss out in wet meadows. Wetlands capture and store spring rain and snowmelt, releasing water in delayed pulses that sustain crops through the dry summer. A report released by a consulting firm in 2011 estimated that restoring beavers to a single river basin, Utah's Escalante, would provide tens of millions of dollars in benefits each year. Although you can argue with the wisdom of slapping a dollar value on nature, there's no denying that these are some seriously important critters. To society, though, beavers still appear more menacing than munificent. That zero-tolerance mentality remains more rule than exception. Beavers are still rodenta non grata across much of the United States. Although our hostility toward beavers is most obviously predicated on their penchant For property damage, I suspect there's also a deeper aversion at work. We humans are fanatical, orderly, micromanagers of the natural world. We like our crops planted in parallel furrows, our dams poured with smooth concrete, our rivers straitjacketed and obedient. Beavers, meanwhile, create apparent chaos. Jumbles of downed trees, riotous streamside vegetation, creeks that jump their banks with abandon. What looks to us like disorder, though, is more properly described as complexity, a profusion of life-supporting habitats that benefit nearly everything that crawls, walks, flies, and swims in North America and Europe. Beavers are also at the center of our own story. Practically since humans first dispersed across North America via the Bering Land Bridge, replicating a journey that beavers made repeatedly millions of years prior, the rodents have featured in the religion, cultures, and diets of indigenous peoples from the nations of the Iroquois to the Tlingit of the Pacific Northwest. More recently and destructively, it was the pursuit of beaver pelts that helped lure white people to the New World and westward across it. The fur trade sustained the pilgrims, dragged Lewis and Clark up the Missouri, and exposed tens of thousands of native people to smallpox. The saga of beavers isn't just the tale of a charismatic mammal. It's the story of modern civilization in all its grandeur and folly. Despite the fur trade's ravages, beavers today face no danger of extinction. Somewhere around 15 million survive in North America, though no one knows the number for certain. In fact, they're one of our most triumphant wildlife success stories. Beavers have rebounded more than 100-fold since trappers reduced their numbers to around 100,000 by the turn of the 20th century. The comeback has been even more dramatic across the Atlantic, where populations of a close cousin, the Eurasian beaver, Castor fiber, have skyrocketed from just 1,000 to around 1 million. Not only have beavers benefited from conservation laws, they've helped author them. It was the collapse of the beaver, along with the disappearance of other persecuted animals like the bison and the passenger pigeon, that sparked the modern conservation movement. I'll stop reading Eager at this point to read from the article about Ukraine and how the beavers have actually had an impact on one region there during this terrible time. This article, I'm finding it on businessinsider.com. The headline is, Ukraine credits local beavers for unwittingly bolstering its defenses. Their dams make the ground mushy and impassable. By Sophia Ankel, January 13, 2023. Local beavers are helping Ukraine defend itself from a potential new front in Russia's invasion. The animals are unwittingly helping Kyiv by building dams that keep the ground marshy and impassable, a military spokesman told the agency. This helps Ukraine by making it less likely that an attack could come via Belarus, which borders Ukraine, not far north of the capital, Kyiv. Ukrainian officials had warned that Russia may wage an offensive through its ally, Belarus, into a region of Ukraine known as Volyn. Defense forces there, however, have been reassured by conditions on the ground, left impassable by miles of burst riverbanks, thick mud, and waterlogged fields. The swampy conditions have given Ukrainians an advantage and time to prepare. A local military unit called the Volyn Territorial Defense has been conducting daily training exercises in the area, according to Reuters. Its spokesman praised the beavers, which he told Reuters were more working unimpeded, unlike in other years. When the beavers build their dams, normally people destroy them, but they didn't this year because of the war. So now there is water everywhere. Victor Roken, one of the brigade's deputy commanders, told Reuters, on your own land, everything will help you defend it. The landscape, lots of rivers which have burst their banks this year. The unusually mild winter has created ideal conditions for Ukrainians to defend their country. I'll end there for today. I hope you're enjoying learning more about beavers and wetlands. This is Maggie Jones and Natural Wonders. Thanks for listening.